Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And what do I say now?
Well, we could have an argument about whether or not this is really going to be an exciting episode, and if so, to whom.
It's always exciting to me, because I think that going 2 hours with in live radio with the potential to say something that I can't take back that could get me in deep trouble for the next 2 hours is a bit of a challenge.
So it's exciting to you is what we're saying.
Yes, I'm scared.
Ladies and gentlemen, we realize that this episode is quite boring to you, but to us,
it's really, really scary.
It's scary and exciting.
Well, let's see. We need to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which doesn't mean they approve or disapprove. It simply means that is our regulators, and that's the people that you complain to if you think we did something bad. And let's see, what else do we need to say? We need to say that even though it is an investment advisory firm and the two guys here are the principals in that firm, and they're also the two voices on this radio program, doesn't mean this is investment advice. In fact, it is not investment advice. It is educational information when there's a world of difference between the two. Investment advice has to do with your specific, individual, unique, I could say something else, esoteric.
Esoteric is an esoteric word.
Yes. Goals, it's like, and self-defining. And circumstances, whereas information just is about stuff, which is different. You like that? That's another esoteric word, stuff.
Stuff, yes. We try to get complicated here when we talk about these difficult pieces of the marketplace. Stuff. Stuff.
And let's see, what else can we say? We can say that we advertise on this radio station. And we advertise to tell you to listen to the show and or the program, but we don't get paid for the program, nor do we pay KTEM to do the program. We're just here. We're in a net neutral state, which is Texas. No, Texas is not neutral about anything.
What?
Is there anything else we need to tell them? The information that we get and we give on this radio program is information we've gotten from places we consider to be very reliable and very accurate, but we make no warranty or guarantee as the reliability or accuracy of the information that we present on this radio program.
All right.
Lawyers are all going to be very happy. Well, actually, the lawyers get really unhappy at this point because we just said a bunch of stuff that says makes it really hard to sue us.
Man. All right. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Morning, Masters of Management and Wizards of Wealth.
Wow. Boy. That's some good titles here.
I think he dialed the wrong number.
Hold on. My head is inflating.
They richly deserved. I've got a little simple question to start the day off. A few years ago, they changed settlement time on stock trades from 3 days to 2 days. Mm-hmm. With all the computers and electronics we have of today, why should that not be done in just 2 minutes, much less 2 days? I'll hang up and let y'all comment on that, then I'll listen to the rest of your program, which I enjoy every week.
Well,
thank you, guys.
Thank you for calling, and thank you for asking.
And for the great new titles. That's pretty good stuff.
Masters of the what? Management Universe?
I don't know. It's pretty amazing.
You know what management is? Just making men older.
Yeah,
man-ager. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Do you mind if I start that and hand off to you?
You want to just hang on to that and then take this next call?
Sure. Let's hit this... for this next caller, and we'll gently hit the next caller and take another question, and then we will take the questions in the order in which they are received. Please hold. Caller on 773-1400, you're on the air. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you. This is kind of an off-the-wall question, but I would imagine it does happen. You know, you get into some argument with your girlfriend, you know, you got a $100 bill, you know, she grabs the other, you grab and keep it, tears in half, you know, and she don't want to give you that other half to, you know, tape it together. Mm-hmm. The half you got, can you go to the bank and tell them, look, I like to see if I can cash this in. You have a good day.
First thing you need to do, let me answer that one really quick. The first thing you need to do is get a new girlfriend.
Yes.
And the second thing is whoever has the larger portion of the bill.
That's the money. Yeah. The larger portion is what they'll take. You need to have the majority of the bill for them to cash it. Okay.
And a new girlfriend.
And a new girlfriend. Or a girlfriend. He might like having a girlfriend that challenges him on things.
On $100 bills?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some people really like that.
By the way, on the new money, have you tried tearing it in half? You got a really strong girlfriend.
Have you?
Yeah.
You've tried tearing a $100 bill in half?
No, but I've tried tearing one of the new $1 bills in half. I couldn't. Now, you can cut it. But I suppose if you had enough weight on the other end and it was fastened securely enough at some point that it was a breaking.
Let's not cast disparagements on the weight of his girlfriend.
But the point is, you can't take a piece of U.S. currency today and tear it in half with your hands unless you are somebody, unless you're Arnold Schwarzenegger or something.
Right. Okay, so back to that first question, the one about trade settlements and how long they have to do it. When I was first coming into the business, you remember this because I came into your business. It had just moved from, this is the trade jargon, T+7 to T+5. And then, it moved to T+3 and now it's at T2. What does that mean? Well, it means the Terminator's coming back. No, that's not what it means. It means trade settlement it's mandated by the SEC to be
No longer
than 2 days after the trade order, if it's given properly. So given properly is important. Okay, why is it 2 days? Why is it not immediate? We've got a lot of computers going on here. And that's a really good question, and there's a really good answer for it. Because the computers, in many cases, don't talk to each other very well. And now we're going to sound like I'm changing the subject for just a minute. It's not. When you deposit a check for $250,000, don't let your girlfriend rip that in half, just as a side note. How long does it take for you to be able to touch the money, to actually withdraw cash? And part of this depends on your relationship with the bank. The bank says you've been doing this for a long time. You deposit a lot of ripped $250,000, so we trust you. Not that the bank would ever say that about ripped $200. Just follow along. It's an example.
Just lay the ripping out of there.
It's an example.
I mean, we know a guy named Rip, and we don't.
I know a couple. I know three people named Rip.
Let's not put them in the bank.
Okay. So this concept, why is it that they hold the money as long as they do? They've got computers too, right? You've got a routing number on there. When you go to the grocery store, you hand them the check and it runs through the little scanner thing and it's like that it makes the transaction right there. Why does it take so long on deposit? The banks are really good at talking to each other electronically to say, hey, this just arrived. Was this from you? And the other bank will say yes. The same thing is true in the stock market. Schwab and A.G. Edwards don't have computers that are talking to each other telling...
A.G. Edwards still exists?
Look it up.
Okay.
Schwab and Woolworth don't have computers that are talking with each other. I'm sorry. Woolworth doesn't exist.
At least you're consistent.
So the big brokerage firms don't know what the other big brokerage firms own. How's that for weird?
A.G. Edwards is just as existent as Woolworth.
Yes. So, which is directly to the point. If you're buying steel from a company, an actual physical item, when the steel arrives, it arrives. When you're dealing with money, the concept of the bounced check is very real. When you're dealing with investments, it's one step removed. The bounced trade also is real. What it is you're allowed in many cases to loan out your stock. You're also allowed to borrow stock. You could loan out and borrow the same stock. Who owns it? Well, your custodian, whomever is holding that money, whomever is holding that stock, has a pretty good idea who owns it. The transfer agent of the company whose stock is in question has a pretty good idea who holds it. But the time to get that information to the transfer agent or to the custodial person can get variable. It can change. So the SEC has been asking for a long time and working toward a database compendium of all stock trades in the United States. This is an aspirational goal because that is such a huge database. It's going to be many billions of dollars to build this database, which will be the place that does know what's owned by whom and where. And that might make you a little bit uncomfortable knowing that the government knows everything that you own. So that concept is why it takes a couple of days. It's getting better, and at some point it will be just minutes. That point will be when the new form of accounting, and please don't confuse this with the cryptocurrency world. It's a piece that was invented at the same time, but a separate piece of technology, a separate methodology. Blockchain. Blockchain will allow the instantaneous transmission of goods and money, and everyone will know where the money was when it started and where it ended up immediately.
We hope it will.
Well, that's the idea. And where it's working, it works very well. So,
well, there's another factor here. And if you own a stock at, I don't know, theoretically Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch doesn't actually exist anymore, Bank America, and you're on their and you're doing an exchange, and so your stock is traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
Let's do a trade between A.G. Edwards and Merrill Lynch. Just for the fun
not
of it.
No. Because it's Halloween is behind us.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
If you're doing an exchange, and everything that you do is in one brokerage house, de facto,
it's instant.
It's instant. Now, they're not going to take final action on it for 2 days because the SEC allows them 2 days. In some cases, though,
the
money
the
is
settlement is sometimes immediate. You can see it,
and it's really cool. But they have to allow them a maximum of 2 days because sometimes they're pretty darn complicated, and sometimes they're still done on paper, and sometimes they're done in electronic format, but it's not computerized. Believe me, there's a lot of complexities that go into buying and selling a given stock. And like Jake said, there's a lot of background checks, most of which can be done by computer, but some of which have to be done manually. And so giving a brokerage firm or an exchange 2 days to process every 2 business days to process everything is really indicates they're moving at Mach 5.
Yeah.
They're really doing very, very well.
And to go back to that concept of the bank, you can understand it a little. People understand bank transactions slightly better than they understand the underworkings of the stock trades. That doesn't say that they understand them, but at least generally. So that $250,000 check that you deposited, the bank you just gave it to, you gave a loan to them, they owe you this money, they have to go back and verify that the other bank has it. The other bank also has to verify that they have it, because it may have just been deposited there before the check was written
that.
So this is where blockchain comes in, is that you have to start with a snapshot in time of exactly where everything is to say you have $100,000 in your bank right now. We know it's there. That's the beginning of the blockchain. Then when you do a transfer to another bank that does speak to each other, this is the blockchain communication method, that's saying, I can see that you've got $100,000, therefore it is the same $100,000 that just moved to my bank. I have it. It's open and available to the person that owns it.
And there have been frauds perpetrated both in stocks and in checks. Check kiting. Some guy a number of years ago, I remember the headlines in the story where this fellow was, and actually quite a few people were doing it various times, were depositing money and then moving it to another bank and then depositing it and moving it to another bank. And the banks are really interested in high customer service, so they were allowing them to move this money before they check with the previous bank, said, is it there? And they say, yeah, we've got a deposit for that much.
Can I walk through this, sure, this concept? There's some pretty good security around this now. This same scam won't work, so I'm perfectly happy letting you know how it happened. Say you go to the car dealership and you sell your car. So you get $10,000. You go to your bank and you deposit $10,000, and at the same time, you deposit an additional $500 just from a check that you wrote that isn't actually there. So now you have $10,500. You write a check for $10,500 off of that and transfer it to another bank. Then from that bank, you transfer to another bank another $10,500 until you come back to the original bank with that original $10,500. And now you've got a deposit in the bank that it started with of $10,500, and you can take it all out as cash. That bank thinks it's the other bank's responsibility to figure out where the money came from. When all the way back around the chain, they may be telling that first bank you transferred it to that the check bounced while cashing the same check that bounced the second time.
And when you do high-speed transfers of stocks, there can be some question, and the system is gameable, or it used to be and has been, where you really didn't own the stock you just sold.
Right.
You had borrowed it and put it in there, but you borrowed it. Let's say you borrowed it, and you can do this.
This is called short selling when you're naked short.
You borrow the stock on the NASDAQ, and you deposited it on the New York Stock Exchange, and then you sold it on the New York Stock Exchange. And then in the process of doing that, you can move between exchanges and between brokerage firms in such a way, and it was entirely possible to do so, that you never really own the stock that you're selling, and you can sell the same stock multiple times. People have done that historically, and that's why the 2-day settlement, 2 days maximum settlement, is there's all kinds of, every time a scam comes up that does this, they put a fix in place, but soon you don't hear about it.
The end solution.
But there will be another scam, and I'm sure they're going on all the time.
Right.
And the exchanges and the brokerage firms catch them and put a fix on that one, and they need to have enough time to check, in essence.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. The end result, the solution to this, is that there's going to be some methodology where all the banks can tell that the asset truly exists where it exists at the same time. Right now, there's technology that allows that. It's the blockchain, and the big investment banks are going into a private blockchain network that has nothing to do with cryptocurrency. It's not on a cryptocurrency platform. They're building their own blockchain network that's just simply an informational thing. It doesn't have to have these weird currency or commodity things of cryptocurrencies wrapped up around it. It could just be, let me take a step back. Double entry bookkeeping confuses a lot of people. Man, does it seem like I just changed the subject? It's not a simple thing to figure out how to do double entry bookkeeping. If you're trying to teach yourself, it's a little bit of making your brain into jello. But it's a pretty well established set of rules that say debits in one column, credits in another, so that you can see where your deposits are, where your withdrawals are. So you can put your math together and double check it at the bottom. You really know how much money you have at any given time. The first major banking firm to use double entry bookkeeping wound up just about taking over the known world. Are you aware of this? It's the Medicis in the Renaissance of Italy. They started using double entry bookkeeping in their banking and were able to make a massive profit that the other banks weren't, because they could utilize multiple branches of the same bank without having all the deposits being used at each bank. They could use the network of banks' resources to make loans at one branch. This was a new thing, because that whole network of banks that was owned by the Medicis knew how much money they had at each branch. That's kind of a, we think of that as, of course they did, they're banks, but up to double entry bookkeeping, it was a pretty complicated set of calculations to figure out how much money you had. And it very easy to mess up those calculations when it's done by people with quill and ink. Okay, so jump forward. The next layer of technology is not a huge, brilliant concept. It's let's take that concept, only allow more than one bank's ownership to see that. Allow all the banks to be able to see that, yes, you have a deposit here. We just make the assumption that these deposits move around from bank to bank. It's a pretty good assumption because they do. So this new concept is called blockchain. It's basically saying we're locking in each transaction as it actually occurred. We're recording the physical movement from one place to another in a place that everybody can see at the same time. Now, in the banking universe, that's going to be private. It's not going to be seen by the public. But the bankers will be able to see it when the trade occurs. They'll get access to see that the money existed in the place it's coming from. And then it will just simply be yours. It'll mostly be done by computers. The alternative to that is to have a nationwide database owned by the government, which is what the SEC is moving towards. That just looks at every trade so that they know for a fact that, yes, you traded on the NASDAQ and then on the New York Stock Exchange, but we saw where the stock moved from one place to the next. It's a rather complicated subject around a pretty simple concept of we just need to know that you have the thing before we pay you for it. So if you show up with the steal, we see the steal. Then we write you the check. All right, and we got another caller. Caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I was looking at your newsletter, and you talked a little bit about GDP, and you said personal consumption and government spending were the only two things keeping it alive. But the last sentence was, unless we get our other productive parts of the economy moving again, you know, the party's almost over. What are those productive parts of the economy you're talking about? How do we get a jump started? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. That's a good question. Do you want me to start and I'll just two seconds and then hand it off to you?
Okay.
Conceptually, the big part of the spending in the United States is done by just your average person on the street. They're buying stuff, and the businesses that exist in the United States are selling to those people. So if you're buying a car, that car is being sold to you. Okay. When the consumer, that average person, is spending and the companies are making a profit on that, you bought the car, they got the profit. The next layer of spending is the car company turning around and using that money to do something. And they're not. So that's the simplest form of the answer. And then I'll hand it off to you for more and deeper diving.
The other parts of the economy, there are actually more than just the ones I'm talking about. But the primary other parts of the economy that aren't growing at this point, they're shrinking, is manufacturing and the exports. And they're separate things, believe it or not. The problem with consumers driving it and getting nothing from it, you'll notice that our imports, and we've mentioned this in the newsletter recently several times, imports are not rising, but they are not falling as fast as exports. In other words, the consumer is buying something. That's what keeps things going. Unfortunately, the stuff that the consumer is buying is more and more not made in the United States. We're importing it. And that's okay. I don't mind an adverse balance of trade. But if you look across the economy, there are basically two elements in the economy. There's the consumption element in the economy, and then there is the creation element in the economy. The creation element, which we call a whole bunch of different things, production, we call it durable goods.
Generally what you do when you're at work.
Well, yeah, sometimes. The point is that the size, the place where we actually create things is shrinking. And the place where we buy and consume things continues to grow. Now, that is an imbalance. Now, we make up the difference by our net imports, which have been rising. And that's a problem. Now, the tariffs are one, oddly enough, the main reason that the people who are doing this, who are the manufacturers, are doing it. For instance, let me give you an example. We had steel tariffs. We have tariffs in general with the intention of helping the steel industry, but the steel industry is shutting down plants again.
Well, there's still steel tariffs. It's just no longer right. against Canada and Mexico. We still have steel tariffs against everybody else on the planet.
We are. So what's happening is it did raise the price of steel temporarily, and then the price of steel fell dramatically. Why did the price of steel fall? It's now below where it was before the tariffs were imposed. The reason is because there's fewer buildings being built. You raise the cost of steel, and you put a lot of uncertainty about if I'm going to build a building to manufacture widgets that I want to export, I don't know if I'll be able to export them or not because the tariffs might prevent me from exporting them. Instead of building the building here, they'll build the building in Mexico. And so the price of steel in the United States started falling again and kind of went into a tailspin. And this doesn't make the headlines that the steel business is in deep trouble now, far deeper trouble than it was before the tariffs, and it is laying off people and it is closing plants. Now, the big key that you can see, and this is just theoretically, that okay, if we don't produce enough stuff, we're buying it from somebody else and we're consuming it, could this be a problem? We've done a degree of that for a long time, and it's okay because we produce dollars. Here's where the key comes in. The consumer is driving the train. The consumer is the one that's keeping the economy growing. But the consumer is borrowing their credit card balances.
Are growing rapidly.
Recently have been rising at a rate of 8% a year. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a mathematical genius to figure out that if somebody's credit card balances are going up by 8% a year, there will come a time when the credit card companies will say that's enough. And there will come a time when somebody looks at their minimum payment or their balance on their credit card and say, you know, we really don't need to spend so much money. It might be next week. It might be next month. It might be next year. It might be in 2 years.
Or 10.
But this is what we're saying in the newsletter is this is not sustainable. We've got amazingly high employment, although the unemployment rate went up from 3.5 to 3.6. That was just a rounding issue.
Yeah, and it had more to do with the GM strike than anything else.
And it is not a big thing. We are running along at essentially full employment, which leaves the ability to grow very, very, very difficult. Manufacturing is, in fact, laying off people. Now, the noise of the strikes is making it hard to see that, but in fact, the manufacturing employment is shrinking. There has to come a point, and by the way, the consumer spending, even though it was up 0.2% in September, is leveling off, and the debt level that the consumers are carrying is rising. And when you see that situation, you can say this is not sustainable. It is going to run out of gas at some point.
All right, so let me give you another piece. It's basically saying what you said in a different kind of example. Other kinds of growth in the economy are business innovation growth. So let's say you've been wanting to start a new business for 20 years and you've finally gotten the money together to do it. You were budgeting it out 3 years ago and you've got enough money based on 3 years ago's estimates. And then you start looking around at the current prices. 3 years ago, there were a lot of people left out there to be hired. So the wages at the starting employment were lower. You could outsource a bunch of stuff that you can no longer outsource without paying a much larger fee, not just in the tariff, but in just figuring out if you have to pay a tariff. Because you've got to hire people to figure out what tariff is due on what item and so on. So exporting is difficult. Importing is difficult. If you're here, this is a great example. I sat on an airplane last year next to a guy who manufactures home security equipment. Now, when I say manufactures, what he's doing is he was ordering all of the electronic parts from around the world and then putting them together and making them network accessible in his shop in Central Texas. So we had these electronics coming in from all around the world. He was putting them together. He started this business and it was doing very well. It's probably still doing very well. But getting that same business started today, you have to pay higher wages to employees. All of the parts cost more because of tariffs. And if you're just getting started, access to the money to start a business is also tight. Getting a loan to start a business is harder today than it was 3 years ago. So you throw all that together and you recognize this has to do with other things. It has to do with the fact that our economy is doing so well. It's doing so well that we can't stop to do new things because we're so busy doing the things that we do well so well. We've hired everybody that we can lay our hands on to work in business, to work in manufacturing, basically around that's what full employment is. Now, if you have a new item you want to make plus the items you're already making, how do you do it? There's nobody left to hire. You can automate it, but that costs a lot of money. So that's slowing down the new investment in new things. And usually it takes a recession for us to say, hey, we didn't really want to make that other old thing anymore. Let's do this new thing.
There's a couple of other things out there that indicate that things that are likely to slow down. The inflation index that the Fed likes to use, which is the consumption index, basically instead of saying trying to estimate a big chunk of it being the potential rental value of your house, the consumption index says here's what people actually spent money on last month and here is what happened to those prices. It fell last month. In other words, we have a little bit of deflation going on in the United States. Over a one-year period, it's up 1.33%, which is not much, but it's been declining. When you see prices declining, the law on supply and demand has not been repealed. It's very real. It's very powerful, and it's one of the few things we can truly depend on. When prices are falling, it either means there's too much supply.
Or too little demand.
And the supply has not, there's no evidence that supply has increased dramatically. Matter of fact, there's some evidence because of the tariffs that the supply is slacking off, and yet prices are falling. That means that underneath the foundation somewhere, something is declining.
That is
a concerning issue to the Fed. The other thing is, folks, the Fed just cut interest rates 3 times.
They don't do that when they think the economy is doing great.
They're saying all kinds of wonderful things about the economy's on solid footing. It's wonderful. It's doing great. It's exactly where we want it. Well, that's what they're supposed to say. But at the same time that they cut interest rates and said, and they then all go shooting out of the meeting to make speeches and saying the economy's on solid footing. Everything's fine. There's no problem. We don't anticipate lowering interest rates anymore. By the way, the bond market, looking at what the bond market is doing, the bond market is assigning about an 80% probability that they'll cut rates again in December, despite the fact they said we don't think we're going to cut rates again. And they might not, or they might. It's a wonderful guessing game. But the point is that there are lots of indicators out there that the underlying engine is having some problems. The biggest one is that the 140 million, $140 billion the Fed flushed into the money market system on Friday. This was in addition to the $60 billion they'd flushed in earlier. We're talking about a lot of money here. They're pumping into the system to keep the system from locking up. It's kind of like if your engine is running so hard
that somebody has to keep putting a quart of oil in that thing every day.
And that's the way they used to do it with the big industrial engines. If you ran them at max, somebody was literally pouring oil into them at all times. There's something fundamentally wrong in the system right now. And one of the things we can tell you that I'm quite confident is wrong, which the Treasury, by the way, officially denied last week. So I'll give them their side. Yeah, Secretary Mnuchin said that we have nothing to do with the money shortage, the short-term money shortage.
Yeah, that the U.S. government borrowing was not part of it.
The federal government borrowed $193 billion from the short-term money markets last week.
And
$193 billion.
How much money did the Fed pump into the money, the short-term money markets last week?
170, 180, something, about the same amount.
It's really, really hard not to see a pattern.
You know, and it's the issue is that you can, oddly enough, during a recession, if the Fed were to go out and borrow a whole bunch of money in the short-term money markets, it wouldn't be a problem because there's no other demand for short-term money because we're not doing much business. But when the economy is running at full tilt, and in order to grease the, actually, it's the oil in the engine, literally, to keep things turning, the overnight flow of money back and forth between banks, when they start running out of money, or worse, and this is what's actually occurred, in addition to running short on money, the banks have begun to hoard cash. Why are they hoarding cash? Because there's these sudden, the Fed suddenly comes out and wants hundreds of billions of dollars, and they suck up all the cash, and they're concerned they won't have the cash to cover the loans they made today, and they'll fall below the reserve minimums and get their hands slapped.
There's another piece to this, and this is a good one. I just got a letter in the mail the other day. At the same time, I got two emails from the same place. SoFi. Are you familiar with them?
Yes.
They say, hey, we'll refinance your loans or we'll give you a loan. They're not a bank. Well, what are they then? Well, they're what we would call a shadow bank. They're not FDIC. In the advertisement, they're asking me to transfer money to their savings account that is now paying 1.7%. Fine print. Not FDIC insured. What does that mean? What it means is that you've just basically given a loan to a corporation who said in the fine print, we can stop paying you interest whenever we want, and if we lose your money, you have no recourse.
Well, you do. You can sue them.
You can sue them. You go and get in line with the other creditors. Everybody's going to be – the reason why they don't have your money is because the other creditors wanted it before they were bankrupt. So this concept of the private bank, there's a lot of that going on right now. SoFi is one that a lot of people have heard or seen, but there are many of them, and they're making loans, they're taking deposits. That's sucking it out of the regulated banking world. The Federal Reserve has mandated that these big banks, the ones that we were so afraid of failing again, maintain a really high reserve. It's the highest level of reserves that have ever been required by banks ever. So they cannot loan that money out. They can't loan it to each other if the other banks have loaned out too much money. So it's, we've got more money on deposit at the banks than we have for a very, very long time, but less money actively available to the banks to make loans to each other in these short markets because they're required to hold it rather than loan it to each other. So you throw in all these factors with the government borrowing, and what we have is a system that's not designed to have this little cash moving from one bank to another. And it seems like an esoteric problem, but the reality is that this is how payroll gets met in a lot of cases.
And very frankly, if the Fed had not stepped in when they did – with sudden short-term loans, which they didn't used to. The last time we did this, by the way, was the bottom of the crisis in 2008 and 2009. Had they not stepped in with these short-term overnight loans of hundreds of billions of dollars, the system would have locked up and we'd had a crisis and a bank panic. Not good. And that's how recessions and panics, as they're called, start. So we're seeing stress fractures around the edge. And we're seeing that...
Is this stuff fixable? Yes.
We're seeing the consumer is spending money faster than they have it available to them. And we're seeing the fact that when businesses are surveyed, they are gloomy and their business – one of the big numbers that's in serious negative territory is business investment. In other words, businesses are not buying new equipment and new buildings to grow their businesses into the future. They have stopped. And when asked why, they say there's too much uncertainty. And the big uncertainty, of course, is the fact that on December 15th, we're supposed to get another big increase in tariffs.
We just had an increase in tariffs on Europe. And that basically doesn't – when I talk to the average American, astute American, these are people that have been planning for their own future for a long time, and I say, who's the trade war with? Kind of as a trick question. The absolutely normal response is China. And I say, and who else? And they say, well, are we in a trade war with anybody else? Well, I think the rest of the world would be sad to hear them say that, because we have tariffs against Europe, across all of Asia, against Japan, South Korea. We just removed our tariffs on Canada and Mexico. But we have massive and eye-watering tariffs with the entire world. We're working on a trade deal with China. So if we get China fixed, that will be helpful. If we get a good deal with China, that will be helpful. That will make the economy purr along for a while longer.
And I want to emphasize, the phase one deal is basically a non-deal. That we've looked at it very carefully. The one that is supposed to be signed, that was supposed to have been signed in Chile, but it got canceled.
Yeah, because of riots in Chile.
We don't know where it might get signed now. But the point is that trade agreement is that China will at some point, in an undefined fashion, buy more agricultural goods, and they will seriously think about
intellectual property
issues, but they're not going to pass any laws to that effect.
So phase two would be them actually doing it, hopefully, actually locking in on that. What is good about the fact that there's a phase one? And we're going to say, after you having just said it's in essence a non-event, we're not really agreeing to anything. The fact that we're signing anything
means
is
it's
a
not
big
getting
deal.
Worse. It's not getting worse.
It's a big deal. And it's more than what we had before the trade war. Now, we've lost a lot in the trade war. Everybody's lost a lot in the trade war. That's what happens in trade wars. The government has gotten more revenue from this. Businesses have lost a lot of money, and there are a lot of businesses that have gone under in the United States because of the trade war. So that's collateral damage. If you look at it from that, wars, can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. But at the same time, if you're the one that owns that business, you don't want to be that egg. We got to play some commercials, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about. It sounds like we're being pessimistic when we're just forecasting weather. Weather happens, and weather happens, and then clears up, and that's what we are forecasting: is that we will have weather, and on the other side of that, we'll have the ability to continue growing. And I'm going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you would like to join the conversation, would you like to give the number?
254-773-1400.
And we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I want to make something at least partially clear here. We forecast well in advance what we think is coming, because we think that's appropriate, because we are long-term investors. We like to work with long-term investors, and so we think long-term. The news cycle is a little different than that. The news cycle is tomorrow is the distant future.
And the market cycle is one quarter.
and if it goes one quarter, even. The point is that, do I think we're about to have a recession? No. And that's what the headlines, and that's what the commentators, and that's what the people from the Federal Reserve are saying. We're not about to have a recession. The economy is running with a high level of momentum right now.
Yeah, that's not going to stop for this moment.
A year from now, Vanguard's economics group, which is really people I hold in very, very high regard, are saying that there's a 50-50 probability that there will be a mild recession in 2020. I happen to agree with that completely. 50-50. About half of the economists that we read are saying, yep, there's going to be a recession in 2020. And about half of them are saying, no, we'll never have a recession again. Or if we will, it'd be in the far distant future. I guess because I have been at this so darn long, 37 years, I've been doing this now? Yeah, 30. Started in 1982. Because I've been doing this so long, I recognize that we do have recessions and that at some point we're going to have another one. And when I hear people saying this could go on forever, that is a signal
that we're closer to a recession.
We'll never have a recession. Everything is just fine. This will go on forever. Which, matter of fact,
those tend to happen right before.
Somebody said something very similar to what the economist from Yale said in 1929. We are at a permanent plateau of economic prosperity. That's what we're hearing. I mean, we've got it. We've got full employment. We can't employ very many more people. We've got everything running really, really well. We got inflation very, very low. This is as good as it gets, and it could go on forever, at which point I start to get nervous and suspicious because I'm a professional coward. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I have a question. When my daughter was born, we bought her some stocks, and we co-signed for them, I guess, or not co-signed, we were co-owners. And now that she's over 21, we're transferring those shares over to her. We had to get something called a medallion guarantee signature.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference in that and just a simple notary to recognize the signature? I'll hang up the message.
Right. Appreciate that.
A notary public says you are who you are. End of liability. You have proven your identity. A medallion guarantee says, if this is in any ways fraudulent, I'll pay the difference.
So the person with the medallion is putting up, in essence, insurance or bond on their belief that you are who you say you are.
Not only you are who you say you are, they're saying that the stock
and that the money is yours,
is really actually yours. If this turns out to be not true, and let's say I don't know, your stock is worth $10,000, and you get $10,000, or we transfer $10,000 into the ownership of your daughter that you didn't properly own for some reason, they have to cough up $10,000. That's generally, it's banks. Occasionally, major brokerage firms will do it, although they've virtually stopped recently. Banks won't do it unless you have, basically, they are, if, whatever the value is that they're doing the medallion guarantee on, they like to see on deposit so they can take it back from you if need be.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the you've got to be part of a medallion program to have the medallion.
Either a Federal Reserve Bank or a member of the New York Stock Exchange.
Credit union, broker dealer. There are.
Can credit unions do that?
Yeah, banks, credit unions. Not all credit unions, yeah. And not all banks.
Well, if a credit union does it, it's because they're doing it as acting as the branch of a Federal Reserve Bank, because the Federal Reserve has to back up the bank that has the medallion, and the New York Stock Exchange has to back up the broker dealer that has the medallion. I mean, it's pretty complex, because medallion isn't just for the small transaction, I presume small transaction that you're talking about, but the medallion guarantee sometimes runs into the millions and sometimes billions of dollars. And as a result, there has to be enough money backing it up to cover the entire transaction, which is pretty bold. And that's the difference between a medallion. That's why a lot of organizations will not do medallion guarantees. They just won't do them because they have to pay for the right to have that much reserve standing behind them at all times. Which is, again, one of the reasons when we talked about the Fed jumping in with a bunch of short-term cash. If they don't have the short-term cash to cover it, they can't do the guarantee.
Yeah, the SEC has a list of three programs that they endorse. The banks, the Federal Reserve banks have another, and the credit unions have another. So the three are securities transfer agents. Those are actual, a transfer agent is someone that records who owns what stock. They're the ones that tell who owns the majority of a company. Another one is the stock exchange medallions program. That's a bunch of clearing and trust companies. They're the ones that are moving around large amounts of money. Most of the times, broker dealers clear through those systems. And then there's the New York Stock Exchange medallion signature program, and that's anybody with a seat on the exchange. And I think there's a 1,007 seats on the exchange. So medallion stamps are not common.
And they used to be literally a medallion that would hang on a stock certificate.
Yeah.
Or a piece of paper.
It's kind of like the wax seal from a medieval lord or something, only now it's a green barcode stamp, which doesn't look as sexy any way you look at it.
But it's got some really special weird ink in it that you got to keep in a safe because
the ink itself
under ultraviolet light it does something weird.
Right. It talks to you. It starts sending Morse code to you in
says I'm real. I'm real. You can trust me. I'm yes. perfectly good. But
you can have little late night conversations with it.
The actual bottles of ink that are used from the medallion stamp are considered highly sensitive items and are yes. secured like their money.
Yes. And there's different layers of medallions. They go from credit unions are F. That means they are only good for $100,000, all the way up to $10 million plus. And the $10 million plus, if you get that stamp, you have impressed someone somehow.
And they sincerely believe that if it ain't real, they can get it back from you.
Correct? Right. They know where you live, and they own a backhoe. So we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour.
We haven't even talked about the stock market.
No, and we'll touch on what's happened this week and all that good stuff. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the week. We do give fiduciary personalized investment advice to people of high net worth. Locally, that number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletters there, listen to recordings of the radio program going back lots of years, check us out, and contact us or email us directly, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at